one of the assumptions of these videos is that the Jews changed the calendar and it has something to do with the devil. You know, I find that like, okay, that's why you already pressed my crazy button.
Yeah, yeah.
But this point of saying the Jews, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe the Jews have been keeping the same thing for thousands of years from the time of Moses.
Maybe.
You know? Never know. Again, I think the main thing we have to focus on is what we're similar at and stop trying to find where the devil's hiding. You know, the whole thing of the devil is really a Zoroastrian thing and a very pagan thing, that there's an adversary of God. You know, this is, for example, the issue with the Iranians. Why are the Iranians so upset about Israel? It's a very, very simple thing. They, in their culture, always have to find the evil entity in the world. And this is why they call Israel and the United States the big devil and the small devil.
Yep.
There's a reason they're picking these words. It's not by accident. It's the mindset they're in. And this is the same thing that's going on, for example, amongst Messianics, Hebrews, believers, whatever you want to call people that want to follow Torah. They're still in that mindset where they're saying, okay, we're looking for the evil one.
Tell me about it. But in Judaism, in Rabbinic Judaism, in the Talmud, is there a concept? I mean, now that we've kind of moved into a different topic now, but I'm interested in this. Is there any sort of subject matter in the Talmud that deals with a so-called devil of sorts, or even demons, for that matter?
Well, the Babylonian Talmud is full with the concept of demons. This is why this subject from the Talmud, I rather actually don't want to deal with it, because the Talmud itself is heavily influenced by the culture it was in, which is Babylonian Persian.
Right.
So there was a strong belief in demons. The devil himself, I have to remember, the thing of the devil himself, they did believe there was some kind of being that was in charge of the evil side of the world. Again, this issue of two polars is also, again, a Zoroastrian concept. They believed, let me give a bit of a background so people understand. The Zoroastrians are named after a man called Zarathustra, the Thusra. There's different ways, there's at least five ways of saying his name. And this is a Persian religion. They're usually referred to as the fire worshippers because they believe they have a very strong inclination to nature, very similar bit to the Shinto. But a lot of the ancient religions were very, 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 very close to one another when it comes to the issue of nature. Everything had a representation in nature. While Judaism, or the Torah, or the Bible basically says, no, there's nature, but there's God above it. But they always believe that nature is a expression or an infestation of a deity. Now, the Zoroastrians are a very, very small group today. There were actually several very famous Zoroastrians. For example, Freddie Mercury from the band Queen was a believer in Zoroastrianism. And there's actually a few very famous people who were of this religion. The religion originated in Persia and was basically some kind of reversal of the original Persian religion. Everything which was evil became good, and everything which was good became evil. Now, the basic belief of Zoroastrianism is that there's two powers in the world, one of good, one of evil. The good is represented by Ahura Mazda, which is the good deity, the all-knowing good deity. And then there's Ahariman, which is the not all-knowing, but evil deity, which when the universe was created, there was like a space in between them, a vacuum in between them. The good deity knew of the evil deity, but the evil deity did not know of the good deity. And when the evil deity discovered of the good deity, they became rivals. So the problem I always find with the issue of the concept of the devil is that the Bible always says God is the only one in control. And you see this over and over again. He creates everything, creator of light and evil. That, for example, is a verse from Isaiah. Yotzer or vorera. Creator of light and the creator of evil. So basically, God is in control. But because people were heavily influenced by the Zoroastrian teachings, the world started believing in dualism. A classic case of dualism in the Jewish world was actually with the people who lived probably in the era of Qumran. We're not 100% sure about that. That believe that there's the sons of light and sons of darkness. There's actually a book called The War of the Sons of Light and Sons of Darkness. And if anyone ever goes, for example, to the Israel Museum, the structure above the place where the scrolls are kept for the public to see has this white thing that has water spraying all over it. That's supposed to represent a lid of one of those jars they found, but it's white. And then there's this black wall on the other side. And that's the whole idea, is to represent the sons of light and sons of darkness. supposed to be a war, and description is very very militaristic. It's there's like camps and flags and everything and trumpets. It's really a war. And they're set in a very, very specific way. It kind of slightly reminds me, and I read a few things of it, kind of reminded me of the way that the Roman military was structured. But the point there was that they believe there's people who are born to be good and people that were born to be evil. Okay, and when the person wanted to join the Yachad, the word Yachad means together, the togetherness of this group, they had to undergo a certain examination. They have a certain face, they have a certain this, they have hair under their shoulders, they have hair on their knuckles. Their legs are built like this, and that's how they decide if a person is from the Sons of Light, and only then they can join. Now, this information, by the way, slipped into Kabbalah, and there's a thing, for example, the wisdom of the face, Chochmat HaParzuf, which is a way of knowing if someone's good or evil by looking at their face. And I actually met someone who believed he was able to do that, and he would befriend or reject people based on that. And there was this one guy that he decided this guy is completely evil, and he was against him all the time. This person I know him personally. He's the nicest guy in the world. He's a very good person who cares about Torah and cares about people and opens his house to everyone. And there's no real secrets about him because he was secular and he decided to be religious, and he did it in a very serious way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so that's, for example, one of the massive effects that Zoroastrianism had about on the world in general. So really, one of the books I have here that deals with this religion actually says people don't understand the influence of this Persian religion on the world. Mm. It's affected almost everything we look at, and it's affected almost every religion in the world. So Judaism, being the origins of Christianity, Christianity basically took with it everything that was becoming part of the Jewish culture. Mm-hmm. They took it with them, and that became Christianity. Mm-hmm. So this is why we always have to really go back to the Bible and see what's originally in the Bible.
And how
so
these concepts evolved, and so that we can further understand them, right?
Yes, and I'm actually going to bring something up here as well, which you wanted to talk about, which I will talk about today, the issue of heaven and hell.
Ah, right.
Heaven and hell doesn't appear in the Bible. There is no such concept.
No.
There's a heavenly kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's this place where presumably God's entity exists in a more condensed way, and the angels are there and everything, but there's no real heaven and hell. There's basically a spiritual world, and there's the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to go back to the concept of the word devil, Satan, the word Satan really means a someone or something that works against you. And we have several places where it appears. For example, it talks about the angel who disturbed Bilam from going to meet up with the king of Moab. Mm-hmm. And he says to him that he sort of stood as a Satan on the way.
Mm-hmm.
He basically just disturbed him. So it's a disturber. It's something or someone that gets in your way from doing what your plan is. Another place that we find it with King Solomon, that God creates a Satan and it mentions people's names.
Mm-hmm.
So the only place we have an angel that actually is an actual being that's job is really to interrupt human beings from worshiping God is the Satan in the book of Job. I know everyone's going to jump and say, well, what about the book, the verse there in Isaiah that says the Lucifer, the everything? No, the verse there says, Ech nafalta mishamayim heilel ben shachar. It's a morning star, but it's a nickname to the king of Babylon. It's not an angel or anything. It's basically he's calling him the morning star, but so it's not an angel.
One of the things that struck me about what you're talking about, I remember the first time that I investigated the word Mashiach, for example. What exactly is a Messiah? And I was always concerned. The more I found out about this word in the Hebrew, I thought, why does the Christian Bible only translate it as Messiah with a capital M in the book of Daniel? And then I thought, you know, why in all the other 37 places in the Tanakh, why is it not even Messiah with a lowercase or whatever? It was just, you know, and you start to get a little bit suspicious. The other, but what equally stunned me, Yoel, was sometime later, it was pointed out to me that Satan is only in the Christian Bible translated as Satan. Hasatan is only translated as Satan in some key passages, but in actual fact, it appears, I don't know, like 20 or 30 times. In fact, David it's mentioned that he is a Satan to somebody. It even mentions in the Tanakh, if I remember correctly, I believe, that Yehovah is mentioned as a Satan.
Exactly. So it doesn't say that David is a Satan to someone. It says that God created an inclination in David to become a kind of a Satan. He's not mentioned as Satan, but the whole idea of the concept Satan is the word sitna, hatred, really saying, you know, just being opposed to something. There's no, I don't know if there's an actual entity called, you know, this creature with a, you know, legs of a goat and horns and a pitchfork in his hand, and his job is to you know, burn people in hell. I don't think that really exists. I you don't really see that in the Bible, and it's not really part of the culture of the Middle East.
Sure.
It's really something that was brought over from the Far East and was mixed around with other things. You have to remember, for example, in Egypt, they believed also there was the deity that represented daytime, and the one that presented nighttime, and the one that presented nighttime is evil, and there's these demons and everything. The Bible actually rejects these things. It says that they, for example, they worshipped or they sacrificed to spirits which are not gods.
Mm.
You know, so again, the issue of demons. The Bible doesn't really say it believes in demons, by the way.
Mm.
It doesn't say that. It says that there are these things that people understood that maybe they're spirits.
Mm.
You know, but it's not clear.
But let's talk about that because now, actually, remind me. I'll come back to that. But I just want to read.
Let's go into a moment to this concept of the word Mashiach and the word Satan. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that the people who translate the Bibles into English have a reason to do this. They have agendas. It's like the issue, for example, the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. For years and years and years, the Catholic Church, at least from what I've heard, did use the name of God, at least in part of their services.
Mm-hmm.
And then there came an, if this is what I heard from someone who follows the Catholic Church, meaning the person who's following what's going on in the Catholic Church, because he came out of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that now the Catholic Church has decided that, this was a while back, that you don't say the name of God anymore. You're going to say the word Lord because it can start using it also to mean to Jesus. You know, so there's agendas. But when you take the Bible itself in Hebrew and you read it, you know, and you're trying to read it what it actually says, then you start seeing other things. And it happened to me as well. When I decided years ago to actually start reading the Bible, you know, trying to read as objectively as possible, it still takes time to actually start seeing what it is. And this is why it's very important to also spend time in learning the culture and understanding the context that things were written in. The problem is, and I do put a warning here, the problem is that even if you pick up a book about ancient Middle Eastern culture, still people project their own personality and their own opinions into these books. So you have to be very, very careful.
So I have
lots of these books, and there are places where I know this is completely erroneous. There's no proof of this concept, and I give examples of why it's incorrect.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read a couple of passages here, and the first one is 1 Kings chapter 22, and we're talking about one of my favorite prophets. I love this story, and this is Micaiah, but in Hebrew, what is his name?
Again, where are you reading this?
This is in 1 Kings, the last chapter of the first book of Kings.
Oh, you mean Michayahu, maybe?
That's the guy.
About the spirit that leaves to confuse the prophets of the king, yes.
I like this.
I thought you meant Michayahu, but the English it's like the word name. I don't know. For example, I just finished a series of recordings of videos with Keith Johnson, and we went to Beit El. So here's a bit of a few things. So I was talking about the name Yerovam, the person called Yerovam. So he told me that in English people say, I kept on saying Jerobam because it sounds closer to the concept of Yerovam. It's closer. But he told me that people in English say, Jeroboam.
Jeroboam.
Adding sounds that are not there in the Hebrew. No, so
saying, wait a minute.
Or twisting them. You know, for example, I have a son called Yedidiah. The people in English call it Jedidiah.
Jedidiah. Oh, right. Okay. So now this is what he says, Micaiah in English. Therefore, hear the word of Yehovah. I saw Yehovah sitting on his throne and all the hosts of heaven standing by on his right hand and on his left. And Yehovah said, who will persuade Ahab to go up that he may fall at Ramoth Gilead? And one spoke in this manner and another spoke in that manner. Then a spirit came forward and stood before Yehovah and said, I will persuade him. Yehovah said to him, in what way? So he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And Yehovah said, you shall persuade him, go and prevail, go out and do so. And so he gave him permission to go out and be a lying spirit.
So let me point out something. We have the exact same thing, for example, with the Satan in the book of Job. No one's allowed to do anything without God's permission.
That's right. That's right.
Very, very clearly. And we see it here. And by the way, it's Ramot Gilead. I don't know, you called Gilead or something like that?
Thank you.
It's called Ramot Gilead.
I'm reading from the English.
The high hills of Gilead.
Mm-hmm. And so...
So yes, this is another example. And if you go to the book of Job, it has exactly the same.
From verse 6, it says, now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yehovah, and Satan... Now, I've got a little asterisk, and when... Yeah, well, let me just fill you in. In my Bible, this is the New King James, Nelson Study Bible, and when there's a little asterisk next to something, that usually means, it doesn't always mean, but it usually means we're kind of lying to you here, but we have to tell you somewhere else on the page in tiny little writing what the truth is. So if I look for where the asterisk is and where the little note is, it says, literally, now the asterisk is next to the word Satan, it says, literally, the adversary. Now, the interesting thing is that adversary here is capitalized. Satan is capitalized, but in Hebrew, of course, it's Hasatan. And it says, and Satan, Hasatan, also came among them. And Yehovah said to Hasatan, from where do you come from? So Satan answered the Lord and said, oh, I'm from going back and forth on the earth and walking back and forth on it. And then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? So Satan answered God and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his whole household and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hand, and his possessions have increased in the land, but now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And Yehovah said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on this person. So Satan went out from the presence of Yehovah. So it's clear that Yehovah gives him a command and says, this is what I will allow you to do, go and do so, but you cannot do this. And Hasatan cannot move beyond those commandments, right?
Exactly. He's every time he wants to go to take it up a notch, he has to go and ask for permission.
That's right. So we learn a lot from the book of Job in this regard.
Yes. And by the way, the book of Job is a very interesting book because it's not very clear who wrote it and when it was written. And there's really strange in the Hebrew. It's considered to be the most complex book linguistically. It's a very, very strange book. Mm-hmm. I came up with an idea, and I don't know if I'm right about this, but I think that this is an Israelite book written in a very, very early stage based on little tits and tittles here of the language used here. But one of the things I think is that it's dealing – one of the things he noticed is that the four friends – friends who come mm-hmm. to speak with Job are presenting the different – opinions in the ancient world about suffering and punishment, and then the last friend who represents the Bible, the Hebraic, the biblical, the Torah opinion about suffering represents God and says, okay, this is really what's going on. Mm-hmm. You don't know why he decides to do these things. There's always a plan to things, and you just have to accept it.
Mm.
But that's like on the edge of a fork. But basically, that kind of gave me the idea of maybe this is really an Israelite book. It's written just in a dialect that we're not used to, in a style that we're not used to, which means it could be a very, very old book that floated around, that existed inside the ancient Israelite world. Mm-hmm. And it was canonized in the end. It was well spread amongst all the Israelites, and it survived in its original form.
Mm.
Because it could be that other books were readapted or slightly changed to fit a certain dialect and a certain language.
Sure, sure.
But so, here we have something older.
So maybe. how do we speculate the entity that is Hasatan here? Is it just that we have a spirit whose job is to stand in the way, and he comes before Yehovah, and they have a discussion, and he gives him a command, and off he goes to do the will of Yehovah, right? To do the will of the Lord.
Yeah, again, it's the will of the Lord, the will of God. And the thing is that, again, we also have to remember this is like a storytelling. So it could be that it's presenting the beliefs of the people of the time, Or it could be it's maybe using metaphors of something, or taking, you know, ideas from other cultures and using them. But, you know, saying that is a bit stretching it. So it could be that there is some being, some kind of an angel, or some kind of a spirit that's their job, and they're supposed to go around trying to cause people to do things, but only as testing them,
mm-hmm.
only as standing opposing to them, but never opposing God Himself.
Yes.
So really, the Satan has to do with being a Satan to us and not to God.
I agree.
So he's only a servant. He's literally only a servant.
Yes.
He's a nasty
obedient,
one.
But he's an obedient servant.
He's an obedient servant, as he was told, this is your job.
Now,
you're supposed to be the troublemaker.
Let me shock everybody. Yoel, if he is an obedient servant, is he not a righteous servant?
I would say he is.
Mm-hmm.
If he's an obedient servant, he's a righteous servant, and which means that he's doing what he's supposed to be doing, and whatever his job is, that's what he does.
Okay, so I agree. So now everyone's saying, well, but what about, you know, the devil and Satan? What about heaven and hell? Well, let's go back to heaven and hell. You said there is a kingdom of heaven where Yehovah resides, right? But the whole concept of heaven and hell, you know, should we unpack that a little bit more?
Okay, so first of all, I will start off first of all with the fact that, as I mentioned, there is no heaven and hell mentioned in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It only mentions a place called Sheol. Now, there actually are quite a few teachings I've seen from different places about this concept. I never got around to actually listening to all of them. But, you know, the people are starting to realize certain things, that we have all these preconceived ideas that have become the heritage of almost all of humanity,
mm-hmm.
and we don't find them in the Bible. So, first of all, we have this thing called Sheol. What exactly is a Sheol? So usually if you say the word Sheol to an Israeli, he immediately thinks of this concept called hell. But Sheol really appears as either one of two things. It is the grave,
mm-hmm.
the place of dwelling of the body.
Yes.
Or we see, for example, in I think it's in Isaiah 14, I think it points out that there's a place where the spirits of the dead kings are, which is in Sheol. The word Sheol appears in two very distinct contexts. One is sounds as if it's a grave. The other place is basically a place where the souls dwell. Now, what happens to the souls when they go to the place called Sheol? I don't know.
Well, we have a hint, though, don't we? The only hint that we have is Yehovah often says to his righteous, you will sleep, you will live to a good old age, and then you will sleep with your fathers. And so the exactly. only real description that we have is sleep.
So by the way, it doesn't say the word yashin. It says it uses the word shachav, which is to lay down. So that has to do with the issue of being buried. Families were buried in family tombs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me point out another thing. The concept of Gan Eden, usually translated as paradise, but should be the Garden of Eden, is, I like that. I used the Garden of Eden, and I said it with a guttural A.
Yeah, you did.
Like, wait, it's English. Why am I using a Hebrew consonant? Anyhow, it's called Gan Eden. The Garden of Eden is a physical place. It was taken away. It was washed away in some way or another, but it was a physical place. And I think that if we think about it, first man was created technically immortal.
Mm-hmm.
And death came to him because he disobeyed God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not only that he became mortal, he also was punished that he has to suffer on this earth. So I would say, and this is a deduction that I do, is that if man was created physical to be immortal on this earth, what's the point of heaven and hell?
Sure.
What's the point of moving everything to the spiritual world?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the concept of Sheol, this world of the spirits, is something that a person dies, a spirit goes back to God, it goes to some place where it probably sleeps, maybe, I'm not too sure, it sleeps, and it is wakened when the end of days, or whatever you want to call it, happens,
mm-hmm.
and then God passes down the judgment of, you were righteous, you were evil, and then we go back to what appears in the end of the book of Isaiah, that the wicked people will eternally suffer for their sins. But when we say wicked, you know, there's another thing that's very important here as well. When a person sins, it says in, I think it's in, what's the name of it in English? Kohelet, Ecclesiastics, I think it's called in English.
It
says that there is no man on earth that does not sin. Okay, Ecclesiastes 7:20, there is no righteous man in the land which will do good and will not sin.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole thing of running around sinner, like classic Christianity used to do, is kind of silly. People mm-hmm. sin. Mm-hmm. So sinning is one thing, but rebelling is something else. And I think the number of people that we can point out which were really, really rebellious, and we're talking about people who are really evil, is probably not that big.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the prophets say, for example, Israel rebelled against God, it's a question, what exactly are they emphasizing this, but did they really rebel to a level where they just threw everything off? Or was it really the finger was really pointing to the leaders? But that's another discussion.
Sure.
What I would say here is, first of all, I think it's just probably logical, and some people might say it's not logical or irrational here, but again, as we pointed out, I don't know if this got into the recording or not, but as we pointed out, you know, people have their opinions, and it's very difficult to move people from their opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when it happens, we'll know. But our job is to try to do the best that we can.
Amen.
And at the moment, with the tools we have, where we're completely disconnected from the ancient culture, and many people are disconnected from the language, and we're all trying to, like blind people trying to figure out where we are, I think we get credit for trying, at least. I hope.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is very, very important to remember, that people sin, and it doesn't make you evil or wicked or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Being evil or wicked is sinning and the issue of rebelling and transgressing and calculated rebellion and not just making a mistake.
Mm.
Now, probably what we'll see is that at the end of days, you know, God will resurrect everyone. Because I think, you know, people have been battling over where do we see the resurrection in the Bible. And people always go to Book of Daniel, for example, or a verse in Isaiah, "Yichyu metecha," your dead will come to life. And I think it's probably even easier than that. Because if we go on the line that basically Adam and Eve were created to be immortal, and when this whole thing that we're in as our world ends,
mm-hmm.
then we go back to being immortal. So what's the point of just being a spirit if there was a physical body? We have to look at the original plan from Genesis. And we realize, okay, the point is to be alive.
So speaking of Genesis, though, it becomes problematic if we look at Genesis chapter 6 and we find the verse in verse 3, Yehovah said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh." Now, what is the word flesh there? Because I've got different translations that says, "For he is mortal."
So it says, "Lo yadonu uchi ba'adam b'shegam hu basar." So basar means flesh. Literally means flesh.
Okay.
Not mortal.
Okay. There we go. Okay. So it's worth pointing out. And so now people are saying then, okay, so there's a resurrection at some stage. We don't know if that's everyone or if it's just the people who are in covenant with Yehovah or what happens exactly, because the Bible is not, the Tanakh is not absolutely explicit in these regards. So, but what we do know is that we do have preconceived ideas, and people are saying, well, how did we arrive at hell? Where did we get hell from? Well, we know a couple. Do you mind if I offer a couple of things here? Because we know a couple of things about hell, and that is that there is no such place as hell. The word hell in various religions, and I'm sure you know of many as well, that there is not only some form of what's the word that they use?
The underworld.
Underworld. Thank you. The underworld, and the underworld has, you know, like a caretaker, if you like, a proprietor, someone who is in charge of the underworld. And in the Viking religion, Viking, this is where we are. In the Viking religion, his name was Hel. It's not a destination. It's the name of a god, if you like, a pagan deity whose domain was the underworld.
Let me suddenly ask you a question. Let me be the interviewer for a second.
Sure.
So you're saying the Viking religion had a god which was called Hel.
That's correct.
But as far as I know, the Vikings believed in Loki as being the god of the underworld or something like that. No.
So
he was the god of deception. They had a.
That's right. So they had a number of gods. They had quite a number of gods. And
including the most popular one, Thor, which everyone's now going to the cinema to watch.
Is that right?
That raises an interesting question. Are we allowed to watch movies like that? That's another point.
But that, you know, maybe we should discuss that sometime. But hell is the caretaker, if you like, of the underworld. Now, we get that in the English. I don't know why they've borrowed that from the Vikings, but in the Greek, what was the name of the fellow whose domain was the underworld?
I think it was Hades.
That's exactly right. And again, it's not a destination. Hades is not the destination. Hades is not the name of the underworld. Hades is the name of the chap, the god, if you like, whose domain is the underworld. So that's interesting, because what we do know is that in the Hebrew, in the Tanakh, that Sheol is not another god. Sheol is not the name of the person who's in charge of this, and Sheol is the destination. That's it, you know. So interesting. So people, and now people go, well, I don't know about the Greek, I didn't know about the Vikings, and what else? You know, it pays to go back and just check out the origins of the words and where they came from and how it evolved and how we understand it today.
Yes, it is. So, by the way, the word today in Hebrew for hell is Gehenom.
And
the word Gehenom, also used in Greek as Gehenna, actually is related to a place which is literally
valley too far away from where
we live, which is the valley. It's a valley which was called Tophet because of the fires, and also it was called the Valley of Hinnom, Ben Hinnom. So the it appears as either as Ge Hinnom or Ge Ben Hinnom, the Ge of Hinnom or the Ge of the son of Hinnom. And some people presume that Hinnom was the name of a person. So it was a valley that belonged to a man called Hinnom. Mm. That's one way maybe we're looking at it. But this slowly evolved into the idea of, okay, this is Gehenom. This is hell.
Mm-hmm.
And people remembered what happened there, because if you've ever looked into the what's called Bamot HaTofet, the various places of the Tofet, of the fires, they had they sacrificed children there.
Mm.
And they sacrificed children to Molech. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty gruesome place.
Mm.
People would take infants and sacrifice them. It's horrible.
Mm.
And the Phoenicians were also involved in that. There's a place somewhere in North Africa which they found this cave where they found this was a sacrificial place. And there was also a burial site there where they buried the children who were sacrificed.
Mm.
So that was always remembered as the one of the most horrible things ever happened in Judean history.
Yeah.
And it's even to such an extent where they say that the God was so angry about this. Because if we go back, the book of Deuteronomy, it says that the abomination of the nations that they do, or the things that they do is an abomination in the eyes of God. And what does the text specifically point out?
It says they even pass their children.
Pass their children to Molech through fire.
Mm-hmm.
And that was considered the abomination. So God took that as an example of one of the most evil deeds ever done.
So can you illustrate a little bit more maybe how the Valley of Tophet was? I mean, am I to wonder, because I've heard stories about how it was continually used for a time as the rubbish dump, if you like. Was it used for a time like that?
To tell the truth, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, but I do know that it says in one of the prophets that it will be filled up with bones, basically turn into a desolate and disgraceful place.
Uh-huh.
It was literally considered one of the most evil things ever done.
Mm-hmm.
The complete disregard of life, and specifically of a child.
Yeah.
So it was because when we look in the Bible, really the Bible is trying to tell us that yes, there is the judgment of God, etc., but we were born to be alive. So this whole system of killing off people is actually against God. God doesn't like, or beyond that, God hates this practice of sacrificing humans.
Mm. Amen. Amen. And we can very easily, and I will extend that to the topic of abortion. Isaiah 66, verse, I think, 20. Okay, here it is. So is this in reference to the Valley of Tophet? It talks about, in verse 24, and they shall go forth and look upon the corpses of men.
Let me find it.
Okay, okay.
Give me time. Give me a moment. By the way, everything we do in this program, we don't plan. We just start, and
it's totally
this is why we're always trying to find. We don't remember where it is, or we start looking for it in the middle, because it's none of it's planned.
You can so hear you me furiously turning pages while y'all's talking, you know.
So you're talking about which verse?
Well, actually, it's the, you know what? It's the last verse of Isaiah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if this talks about about that specific place, but we do have other places. So you can hear me working on my computer looking for things.
You do that.
By the way, I keep on hearing Nehemiah working on his computer while he's talking.
Yeah, he does a lot of typing.
He does. No, he's typing because I think he's also looking for things.
He's
busted.
And so it says, and they shall go forth and look upon the corpses of men who have transgressed against me, for their worm shall not die, and the fire is not quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all flesh. And a couple of things, if we're talking about the Valley of Hinnom or the Valley of Tophet here, that if it was indeed a historic garbage dump, if you like, they would burn the rubbish and there would be the maggots. And when we're talking about the worm shall not die, the maggot has got plenty to go through. Any dead animal or whatever you take into an unclean place, you dump it there, and there's lots of, well, you know, maggots, there's lots of fire, and they burn it. And that's the imagery that we have when we have. The other thing that's worth noting then is that the Valley of Tophet is worm heaven.
Is what?
Worm heaven.
What does that mean?
Because the worm does not die.
Oh, okay.
They're happy.
So by the way, today, if you go to the Valley of Hinnom, there's grass there and children playing. By the way, so I'm looking here at a few things about Molech and the whole thing of burning children. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. He always has horns.
Ah, that is interesting. Is he not displayed as... I don't know. I haven't...
I've seen cases where he's displayed more as an ox.
Yes, an ox.
But I've also seen cases where he's displayed as a human being with horns. Kind of like the devil.
Interesting. Now, are you in Deuteronomy chapter 12, if my memory serves me correctly? Is that where you are?
Well, not necessarily. But we have Deuteronomy 18, verse 10.
Okay.
Which points this out.
Yes, it makes very much the same point. This is, I'm in 12:29. It says, "And Yehovah your God cuts off from you before you the nations which you shall go to dispossess, and you displace them and dwell in their land. Take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, and then you do not inquire after their gods," like Hades and hell, "saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I will do likewise. You shall not worship Yehovah your Elohim in that way, for every abomination to the Lord, which he hates," every abomination to Yehovah, "which he hates, they have done to their gods, for they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add nor take away from it." What have you got in 18?
So 18 says, "You shall not find amongst you a person who passes his sons or daughter in fire." Mm-hmm. I think one of the bigger ones is also in, I think that's in, I'm looking at something else, but there's also in Leviticus 20, verses 2 all the way to 6, is even more elaborate. It talks about the punishment and what it is, and that God will put his face in that man and his family, and he'll cut him off, and all the people who follow him, to follow after the Molech, he'll cut them off out of their people. Mm-hmm. So here we also have that. It's mentioned in several places.
You know,
and
what
it's interesting
says?
That this specific one is always pointed out,
mm-hmm.
because it could be that this was like the most problematic of them all. Mm-hmm. But it does mention other ones, for example, Baal Peor, which the Israelites followed after they came in contact with the Moabites. Baal Peor is kind of they claimed they had a weird, kind of strange and sick cult around it.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, it's very interesting that Molech has specifically pointed out here. And I also find it interesting that he's always depicted as more like either looking a bit human or ox-like, but with horns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always to do with fire. So this is some kind of maybe devil worshipping, if we compare it to anything that we can compare it to.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
But
it's not a concept that's been taken from the Tanakh. It's a concept, obviously, but that's been taken from pagan nations. So there's a couple of things come to mind, Yoel. One is is a going down. The other is a coming up. Let's deal with the going down first. The going down occurs in the wilderness when a chap decides to almost attempt to throw a coup over Moses, and gets the men that supported him get swallowed by the earth and they go down. And I think that you could hear...
You're talking about Korach.
He's the one. That's the one, right. Now, where is that? Is that Numbers? I think we're in...
That's in Numbers. I'll tell you exactly where it is. That's in the book of Numbers. Can you hear me turn pages? It starts off at chapter 16.
Yes.
And it goes through the entire chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, chapter 16 is the chapter that deals about this. So they're taken... It says here that if he says they've called, sent me, may a being be created and the earth will open up and swallow them. Mm. And it says here that they were taken.
Oh,
so it says in verse 32, yeah. Verse 32 says, and the earth opened up its mouth and it swallowed them and their house and all the people which call ahead and all his belongings.
Mm.
And they went down, all of them to alive down to Sheol, and the earth covered upon them and they were lost from the congregation.
Mm.
So here, probably users, you know, they might have believed that Sheol is underneath us. You have to remember, they believed the world was flat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the heaven was stretched over the earth. And actually, says in one place, and vigolu hashamayim, the heavens will roll, meaning they will roll as if there's something stretched, and then you release something, it rolls, and then everything's exposed. So mm-hmm. they actually believed the earth was flat. There was this dome or something, or some kind of almost like a cloth. Basically, the same idea as you have in a tabernacle. They had this cloth over the earth, which was the heavens,
mm-hmm.
and there were little holes, which were the stars, because there was a light coming out from some other place. And there was flat earth, and underneath it was a place called Sheol. So that also has to do with their beliefs as people.
Mm.
And so I think what it means is that they were swallowed down, but they were swallowed down really, really deep, beyond what a person just regularly digs. And you also have to remember, you know, when you dig down, 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 you basically getting closer and closer to the core of Earth, and to the layer of lava, it becomes hotter and hotter.
Mm.
So people understood there's something underneath there.
Right. So the concept of, or the traditional Catholic concept of hell was that it was in the burning lavaous center of the earth. And so yeah. It's interesting. So
I actually watched an evangelical movie
mm-hmm.
About the end of days. I decided to watch it just to try to learn a bit about these types of people,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's a lot of types of Christianity around the world. And I try to, you know, keep my head organized regarding different groups. And I was watching this movie, so the devil in the end goes out, and then God comes out of the heavens and throws him down. So how do they depict him being sent back to where he is?
Mm-hmm.
The earth opens up, he falls down into the lava, and it closes on him, and he has chains on his hands. Okay, you know, so that's actually a very Catholic way of looking at it.
Mm.
And really, I think in the ancient world, and you know, they probably, this is how believed, earth was smack in the middle, and between, our world was smack in the middle between heaven and hell.
Yeah. And so I'll also throw this in, speaking of the Catholic interpretation and understanding of hell, I will say that hell, the understanding that we have of hell today, or the traditional understanding, was perpetuated by the Catholics. The question is, why was it perpetuated by the Catholics? The answer is St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. They needed to scare people into buying what is called indulgences. They needed the moolah. It was expensive business, and you scare people into paying their way out of hell in certain respects.
Well, all religions did that. This is the unique thing about the Bible. All religions did that. For example, in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
In Egypt, there was a thing called the Book of the Dead. And the Book of the Dead was basically an instruction book that tells you what to do after you die. Now, each book was individually written for individual peoples. And the Egyptians, the way they believed was following things. First of all, you have to be buried inside Egypt. Now, a lot of these religions also had an occult around the spirits of the family, because you have to have the family attending the dead. So
mm-hmm.
we have this concept of worshiping the dead, which appears in the Bible. So in the Israelite burial system, they just buried the body. There was no rituals around it. There was no occult around it. There were no sarcophagus to the level that, for example, the Canaanites, if you see a Canaanite sarcophagus, you have, sarcophagus is the box, nashuary, or mm-hmm. depends if it's a nashuary or sarcophagus, but it had an image of the person who's buried inside. The Egyptians did the exact same thing in all the periods. So the Pharaoh received, you know, his face literally engraved in the metal. Later period after Alexander the Great, they would paint the face of the person, for example, in a very Greek style, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea was the family had to come and put food there and offerings and tend to the tomb. Now, the Book of the Dead, basically, when a person dies, they had to know how to deal with all these demonic beings on the way that don't allow them to reach this place, which was the eternal fields of paradise, mm-hmm. or some of that effect. And this person had to go with, when they die, they wake up as a spirit, and they have a scroll with them, and they go from stage to stage, and there's incantations that they have to say. And there's these different, there's like four, I think 43 gates that they have to go through, with each gate having some kind of a being in front of it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
Now, the thing is that these books were very expensive. That was the shtick.
Uh-huh.
So what you do is you convince everyone that you need this. And then when you need this, then you pay money for it. And we're mm-hmm. talking sometimes of things that will cost half a year wager to buy.
Sure. And this is so this book is your guide in the afterlife through the underworld. Who's going
to
complain?
To save to save yourself, to save yourself, to save your soul.
That's right.
And they were describing, the monsters were described. So, for example, the whole idea in the end is that if you pass all the things on the way, you reach this place, which is the entrance to heaven,
mm-hmm.
and there's a scale. Again, the issue of weighing your sins, okay? This issue of a scale that decides, it became part of a Jewish world, but we don't see that in the Bible.
That's right.
The way you also have that amongst the Zoroastrians. If you actually take the character of Metatron or Mithra,
mm-hmm.
the way it's used in the Talmud and the way it's used in the descriptions of the Venda Vesta, which is the Zoroastrian writings,
mm-hmm.
they have very similar characters. But there's this weighing, you can see how it influenced the Jewish one, then it probably passed on to other places. But there's this weighing of your actions. So in
mm-hmm.
the Venda Vesta and the Jewish world, etc., how it is that they put your deeds on a scale and they weigh them. And if your good deeds are more, then you can enter heaven. If your bad deeds, you go there. It really depends. There are also types of deeds. But anyhow, we're not going to go into the
But it's typical of most every other religion, isn't there? That there's some sort of scaling system that determines whether or not you pass the test. And this brings us to Ezekiel 18, doesn't it?
So the thing is, the person comes in. So instead of weighing their deeds, they weigh their heart. So there's this scarab they used to have on their chest, which they'll put on the scale,
mm-hmm.
and there's this the feather of truth, where this goddess will put it on. And if they weigh out exactly, then you are a truthful person and you enter. If they come out of balance in any way, you get devoured by this beast and your soul is completely evaporated. So we have this issue of people making money off of people's fears. And that's done all the time in every culture. That's how you control the masses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we go to Ezekiel 18, it says something completely different.
So
Ezekiel 18 says...
So I've got it here from verse 28. Well, actually, let me read from verse 25, because it says, Yehovah says, "Yet you say the way of Yehovah is not fair." Now, in the King James, it says weighed. Do you want to translate that word for us? I have...
Weighed,
like weighed in the balance on the scales. So verse 25, it says, "Yet you say the way of the Lord is not fair. Hear now, O house of Israel... Is it not my ways which are fair?"
Yeah. So there's an issue here because it says "lo yitachen derech Adonai." So yitachen can be from the word tochen, which means lo yitachen. The word yitachen is usually used in Hebrew, in modern Hebrew, and also in the Bible, used for not plausible in logic. But it also can be yitachen from a root that means to weigh. So it is possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is impossible to weigh. So it's quite possible.
It's quite possible then that they're complaining. They're saying, every other pagan religion, they have the scales and you do the good, you do more good than bad, you're okay, you're
in. You got this guy who was a murderer and whatever. But most of his life
he was good, right? And so... his good outweighs his bad, and so he's all right. But what God is saying to us is that his ways aren't weighed in the balance like that. They're not put on the scales. What it says in Ezekiel 18 is that what he wants is faithfulness. And he says if a man has done terrible things his whole life and lived wickedly all his life, and yet at the end he repents and he turns, then all of his wickedness shall be nothing. And vice versa, if a man is faithful all of his life and he does righteously and yet in the end does wickedly and does all these abominations, then none of his righteousness shall be remembered. What he wants is faithfulness.
By the way, I'm looking at this, and it is a verb. I thought it is a verb, and it's in a certain stem. That's why there was a certain pattern in the word that hinted it. So, actually it's from the root of takan, which means to be estimated or weighed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yes, I this is probably the argument here that they're saying, this is not something we can make sense of. And then, as you said, they're comparing exactly.
Yeah.
Now but God basically says, there's an option of repenting.
Yeah. And the most important thing is to remain faithful. Let me talk about, now we discussed the going down, being swallowed into the earth. Let me talk about the bringing up, because now I'm in 1 Samuel chapter 28. That one there, because you can't talk about...
By the way, the book of Samuel...
Well, first of all,
the book of Samuel is probably one of the most fascinating books, because it gives us a lot of information regarding the Israelites and the ancient and the world they were living in and their beliefs. Because Joshua just gives us an account of what happened in the wars, mm-hmm. and what happened afterwards. Judges just tells us how corrupt the people were. Mm-hmm. Samuel really gives us a lot of information. There's a ton of information in the Book of Samuel regarding the time and the culture, and also the history of the place.
Mm-hmm.
So after we've said that, encouraging people, read the Book of Samuel. It's
read the Book of Samuel. Well, this is a particularly, you have to admit, this is a particularly curious verse, because here Saul is scared. He's supposedly banished all the witches from the land, you know, no more of that, and yet he thinks, and Samuel's not there anymore, he doesn't know what to do, so he does go and consult a witch. He finds the witch of Endor, well, he goes there and he says...
It's not a witch, it's Ma'ala Be'ov, which is a woman that brings up spirits, a medium of sorts, and the word Ma'ala Be'ov, so they say the Ov were as if they would speak in a very, very low voice. The spirit, mm-hmm. they allowed the spirit to take over them and speak through them. So it's basically a type of medium.
Yep. So here we are, and he says, she says, now, who do you want me to bring up? He says, would you bring up Samuel for me? And the woman freaked out. And this is verse 12. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice, and the woman spoke to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me? For you are Saul. And everything just seemed to become apparent to her then. And lo and behold, here is Samuel in some sort of form up from Sheol. And Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? Now, how do you understand this passage?
So let me first of all explain several things. First of all, she says, I see Elohim coming, rising from the land. So we have this understanding, first of all, that there's something rising from the land itself, coming from underneath. So she knows it's a spirit. So it seems as if she had a vision. She has this kind of vision before she's taken over by the spirit.
Okay. Now before you go on, I got to ask you this because you're just quoting verse 13. I have to read this now because my Bible says a totally different thing, and I need to go through this step by step. Verse 13 says, "In mine, and the king said to her, 'Do not be afraid. What do you see?' And the woman said to Saul, 'I saw a spirit.' Now here I have an asterisk." Lo and behold, here's an asterisk. I have to go hunting for the tiny little writing that tells me what the asterisks mean. And just as you said, Yoel, the term it says in tiny little writing in Hebrew, Elohim. I saw Elohim, not a spirit. I saw Elohim ascending out of the earth. So he said to her, what is his form? And she said, now tell me if you've got the same in Hebrew. She said, an old man is coming up and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel, and he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed down. What do you have in verse 14?
Does she remember what the word mantle means?
Oh.
I just remember, I am a Hebrew speaker, so there's a lot of English words that I don't automatically remember.
So I don't know how to translate that. What is a mantle? Is it some sort of robe or?
Probably. So it says an old man wearing a me'il. And a me'il was basically a thing which was basically an overcoat.
So this is the
symbol of Samuel,
uh-huh.
that he always wore this overcoat, because it says that his mother made for him a me'il. So it's not a coat, literally a coat. It's just something like an extra piece of clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to remember that the important personnel, the more important you were in society, the more covered up you are. An example of that would be the priests in the temple, that they wear longer clothing. Men usually wore probably some kind of thing around their mm-hmm. waist during the summer. Maybe they wore some wool or something over when they went during the winter. But during, you know, and women probably wore something, you know, a lot more covered than that.
Mm-hmm.
But the more covered you were, the more important you were in society. And the longer your clothing, the more important you were in society. But regarding the word Elohim, I actually looked this issue up a while back. And it actually says that the word Elohim first of all, the word Elohim has different meanings in the Bible. It can mean usually means God, but it can also mean someone in position of power. And when I was looking this up, it pointed out that it was in the I think more northern world at the time that the word Elohim was also used for the word spirit. So it's not that it's a mistranslation or they deliberately changed something. They were actually probably going into the actual meaning of what it says.
Because there is various uses for the term Elohim, and one of those we find...
Yeah, there are various uses of the word Elohim. I'm just trying to find the actual source that I saw, because this wasn't long ago. This is why I remember it. So let me attempt to find it.
While you find it, I'll just give another example. This is Psalm 82, and it says, God stands, Elohim stands in the congregation of the mighty. He judges among the gods. But hey, I've got a little asterisk there, Yoel. I go down to the tiny little itsy-bitsy writing, and it says in Hebrew, Elohim. Now, they've interpreted it as mighty ones, that is, the judge. And they do that a number of times in this particular chapter, this short chapter, Psalm 82. It goes on and talks about, in verse 6, I said you are gods, that's Elohim, and you are my children of the Most High, and so on and so forth. So there's another example of a slightly different use of Elohim in reference to judges.
Yes.
But in this case, you're saying it's in reference to a spirit. But in any case, a judge is a mighty one, a spirit is a mighty one, El is the mighty one. And so there are these various uses for the term.
So I'm actually having trouble finding it. It's probably in one of the other books I was looking at.
Sure.
But anyhow, the point is that he points out, this person who wrote this book points out that the word Elohim here in this context is used as the word spirit. So it's not a mistranslation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But now, as we read on, though, it says, and Saul perceived that it was Samuel. And he stooped down with his face to the ground and bowed down. Is that what you've got?
Yeah, he bows down to the ground.
And he perceives that it is Samuel. Okay, so now...
And then suddenly Samuel starts talking.
He starts talking. Now, there's no reason at this stage for us to think this is not Samuel, right? Because now in my tradition where I come from, I am often told, oh, no, that's a demon. But where do we get the concept of demon from? We're right back here. But here we are, at least when I read this, I think there's no reason for us to not think that this is the spirit of Samuel. So
no, there isn't. It actually says it's Samuel, and it Samuel says. Speaks. So
yeah. Let me ask
one
you.
Thing that's very clear, the text says it's Samuel, and Samuel appears, and he appears in a way that, you know, she knows it's him because it's an old man wearing this overcoat.
Yep.
And that was the symbol of Samuel, because that's what his mother gave him when he moved to the temple. And this was like Elijah. It says about Elijah, the Yahoo, that he had long hair, and he always wore this overcoat, this over thing that was also hairy.
Sure.
You know, so there's a whole, the people were identified based on a certain characteristic of something that was external. And that's how they knew who this person was, him.
But he says, you and your sons, you, tomorrow you are going to be with me. So there it is. There's the going down and the coming up. And there's Sheol, as opposed to heaven and as opposed to hell and Hades that don't exist. How shall we end this? Boy, we weren't expecting this conversation. How are we going to wrap it up?
No, we weren't. We said something. We wanted to talk about first fruits or something like that.
We said, should we do a program on that? It's only got 3 verses in the Bible. Surely we could talk about something else. How are we going to wrap this one up?
How are we going to wrap this one up? It's a very, very good question.
Is there anything else that we should highlight before we let everyone go and do their own investigation? And we would love to hear comments or any questions.
Well, I would say the issue of the spiritual world, we actually do see in the Bible kind of a development. For example, angels. This is an example. Angels in the beginning have no names. And then suddenly at the end of prophecy, when they return from Babylon, angels suddenly have names. In the book of Daniel, in the book of Zechariah, they suddenly
Gabriel,
have names.
Yeah, and there's Michael.
And the Talmud says something very, very interesting. Before that, for example, all the angels that we have are have to do with an action that they're doing. For example, it talks about Pil'i or Maflila Asot, who appears before, I think it's the parents of Samson, and he's
and
there
said,
just
is,
because
what is your name? And he says, why do
and
you
he,
ask
and he, give, yeah, and he gives him, a kind of a name, but it's not really a name. It's more of a description. Of what he is.
Mm.
Here, we suddenly have actual proper names. Gavriel, Michael, and then the whole issue of names, naming things, and suddenly, you know, in the Jewish literature, suddenly the angels, like there's tons and tons of angels with many names, and I think that we have to just be very, very careful with allowing different developments like this to enter our world. And this was a real point of this entire discussion, that we really, to understand almost everything that we need to understand about the spiritual, we really have to go back into what was then and what actually appears in the Bible, and be careful not to mix things in, so we actually get the real opinion of what the people in the Bible believed. But it is a very, very interesting question. How is it that even books in the Bible, we see this development, this influence from another culture? It is a very, very good question, which I do not have an answer for, but it's been disturbing me for a very, very long time.
But it's very valid what you say, because, I mean, you mentioned the book of Daniel, and one of the very key verses to this whole discussion is Daniel chapter 12, verse 2, which says, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt." And it's one of the very few verses that we have that sort of indicate what will happen according to the prophets. So if we continue along this line, we're going to be on the radio for another hour.
We're going to be on the radio for another hour. But I would say another thing, and right. I actually just posted on my Facebook about this, the Hebrew and Israel Facebook, that we have to be very, very careful with influences of things in our world which go beyond religion. We basically go beyond what the Torah says. Mm-hmm. We have to be very, very careful with things that we adapt to our world. And a classic example of that, and if anyone goes to my Hebrew and Israel, they see it, it has to do, for example, with different amulets that people wear. It's things which are very popular here in Israel. And this is what the Torah warns us about not adding to the Torah. Mm-hmm. It's not just interpretation of verses and changing things. That's one thing. But we actually have real adding to Torah or real things which are considered to be witchcraft or anything like that, mm-hmm. which are added into the Torah, or added into the practice of our everyday life, that we have to be very, very careful with. Sure. So everyone, I'm not saying just believers in Yeshua, I'm saying even Jews, everyone, we all have to dig deep, deep down inside into our cultures and see what have we adapted from other places which are against the Torah. Because I can say this very clearly. I can point out the flaws and the problems amongst believers, but I can do the exact same thing in the Jewish world as sure. well. And it's not an issue of criticism. I want to clarify something. I've had this happen over and over again. When an Israeli criticizes something, it doesn't mean that we're necessarily attacking. Mm-hmm. It's not an attack. It's trying to clarify things. It's the same thing here. I'm not attacking anything. I'm just saying, okay, let's do a bit of work on ourselves to see what we might find is wrong, mm-hmm. and maybe even share them, because sometimes things from my perspective I won't see, and things from another person's perspective they won't see. And it's like I pointed out earlier, that we really are all on a journey, and hopefully in the end we'll see the solution and the answers to everything.
So we share what we believe to be our insights. Mm-hmm. You know, it may cause the light to go on for somebody else as a different perspective. Exactly. And it's always, and this is the point of our discussion now, is that it is food for thought, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And everything we spoke about now, up to now, is just food for thought as well.
Food for thought. Well put. And so we would
feed your brain.
Yes, we would be interested in comments. Any questions? Would love to hear from the listeners. I've been speaking with Yoel Ben Shlomo, and the email address, if you would like Hebrew lessons from this very knowledgeable man, is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. You can also find him on Facebook. Just do a search for Hebrew in Israel. My friend, thank you again for your time.
You're welcome. And I hope this is beneficial for everyone. I know it's a bit controversial. And I have spoken out of the Jewish tradition I grew up in, so people realize that there are things that I do agree that are not acceptable in the Jewish world that we have to be very, very careful with. Mm. So this gives you a bit of an insight of who I am. Very I might be Orthodox, but I'm also trying to think and figure things out.
Yeah, you're not pinned down in the box. All right, my friend, I appreciate your time. And until next time, dear listeners, be blessed to be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, kol tov. And enjoy.
Enjoy what?
I don't know. You can cut that out.
I thought you were going to say, I'm waiting for you to go. I'm thinking, I just entered your brain as if you were about to say, enjoy Passover, but I'm not sure when this is going to be published.
That's basically, I was about to say enjoy your Passover, and I'm thinking, when on earth is he going to put this up?
As you went, enjoy. And as soon as you said that, I knew you were thinking, when are you going to publish this?
Exactly.